Hello, and welcome back to Current State. I'm Kevin Lavery, filling in for Mark Bayshore, who's away. It's nice to have you along with us today. We have a great show lined up for you. We're going to hear part two of Mark Bayshore's interview with MSU Athletic Director Mark Hollis, and then we'll also speak with some members of the Happen Dance Company of Okemos ahead of their performance this weekend. We'll learn how they translate the experience of PTSD into dance. And we'll learn about an exciting new stem cell discovery that's happened right here at Michigan State University. We hope you'll stay tuned for all that. You may have heard that the Broad Art Museum at MSU has named a new director. Mark Olivier Waller will replace the founding director, Michael Rush, who passed away about a year ago. Waller is currently the founding director of the Chalet Society in Paris. He brings more than 20 years of experience to the Broad, and he's curated more than 400 exhibitions around the world. Mark Olivier Waller's appointment is effective on July 1st. To start off our show, $100 a day. That's about how much it would have cost to add anti-corrosives to Flint's drinking water after it switched from Detroit's system in 2014. The price tag for fixing the water crisis has gotten a lot bigger since then. Flint estimates it will need at least $55 million to replace corroded lead service lines. And now Governor Snyder is requesting $1.2 million to pay for the state's legal fees. Attorney General Bill Schuette is also hoping the state will give $1.5 million to his office's investigation into the crisis. Here to tell us more about the mounting bills related to lead in Flint's drinking water is Detroit News political reporter Jonathan Osting. Jonathan, it's nice to have you back on Current State.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Sure. Let's start off with Governor Snyder. He is requesting, as we said, $1.2 million. This is for legal fees associated with the water crisis. What specifically would that money be used for?
Well, there's a couple things going on. One is that the governor is part of or named as a defendant in several civil lawsuits filed against the state, various actors within the state, various state departments, by Flint residents. And the other is that he's the subject or the state is the subject of investigations. So these attorney fees are mostly going to go to lawyers to represent the governor in civil cases, but also help process during the discovery phase, it's called. So attorneys are requesting lots of information from the governor's office, documents, records related to the Flint water crisis. Reporters are also requesting those materials. And while the governor isn't subject to the Freedom of Information Act, he has been making those documents available. And then finally, the investigators are requesting these materials. Attorney General Bill Schuette's probe is asking for documentation or will be from the governor's office. So the governor is retaining attorneys to help process the collection and dissemination of those documents in part.
Well, if you're a Michigan taxpayer like you and I are, Jonathan, you're probably wondering where this money is coming from. Is this coming from the general fund for the state or maybe some of the state's budget surplus?
Well, this is coming out of current department budgets. There's no supplementals right now to fund this. The request actually came out of, for the governor's funding, legal fees from the Department of Technology Management and Budget. And then the attorney general is requesting a contract through his normal allocation at this point. That's not to say additional funding might not be necessary eventually. But what actually happened this week was simply the contractual process. The state, anytime it enters into contracts, these have to go before the administrative board. And that, well, it is a request, but it's sort of, one could say it's sort of rubber stamped at this point. The administrative board actually is comprised of representatives from the governor's office, from the attorney general's office, from the treasury. So the subcommittee approved the funding this week, and it's going to go to before the full administrative board later this month and likely will be approved.
Okay, so they are the final authority that says yes, this will go or no, it will not.
Yeah, they basically are asking themselves for money, so I imagine it will go through.
Usually, Jonathan, it's the attorney general of the state who is in charge of legal representation for the state. Why is Governor Snyder in this particular case bringing in outside counsel?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, as they've said this week, simply the volume of documents they're having to process. And two, there's obviously some complications here, right? You've got the Attorney General on one hand investigating the governor's office. On the other hand, and they say this is firewalled, they're separate, but on the other hand is, you know, typically going to play a role defending the governor's office in these civil lawsuits. So it gets a little messy, gets a little complicated. Okay, so I don't think it's highly unusual that the governor would bring in some outside attorneys here. We'll see who actually ends up being the lead in any of these investigations, in any of these defenses. The Attorney General's office, as I mentioned, does say it is creating a strict firewall between these separate units that are at once investigating the governor and perhaps helping defend him in court. In fact, the investigatory team they've set up is, for instance, establishing its own computer network separate from any state computers so that it couldn't be, you know, perhaps accessed by someone who should not be seeing that material. So there are certainly protections being put in place, but that doesn't mean it's not an unusual and messy situation.
Sure. And as we said, there are actually two separate investigations going on, one initiated by the governor's office, one from Attorney General Bill Schuette's office. As we said, he is requesting money to the tune of $1.5 million, slightly more than what the governor is asking for his own office's investigation into this water crisis. You mentioned a firewall here and some protections. What is the AG's investigation specifically going to entail? Is that separate from what Governor Snyder is pursuing?
Yeah, definitely. The governor is doing sort of a review of state departments to see what went wrong and how they might fix it. The Attorney General's office has said explicitly it's looking to see if there's any criminal negligence here at any level of government, be it the local government, the county, the state. So those are definitely, you know, separate and distinct investigations. In the case of the Attorney General's office, that $1.5 million funding request is being used to hire a large team of prosecutors and investigators. I think 25 people in total. Of course, Todd Flood, an attorney out of Royal Oak, is going to be the special prosecutor in this case. He and about 9 other attorneys are going to be making $400 an hour on this case, which the Attorney General's office said is actually less than he would probably make in private practice, but still sounds like a big figure for taxpayers to foot. Separately, former FBI Detroit Director Andrew Arenas is going to be the lead investigator. He's going to be making something like $160 an hour. But there's a large team here that's going to be looking into a lot of different things related to this crisis. There's IT costs, as I mentioned, and things of that nature. So that's where that $1.5 million request, at least the initial request, is going to be going towards.
So some large checks will be written in the very near future for all this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be another expense. This is, of course, completely separate from the expense of actually resolving the crisis.
We're talking with Jonathan Oesting. He's a political reporter with the Detroit News based in Lansing. We're talking about the mounting bills for the Flint water crisis and the requests from both Governor Snyder and Attorney General Bill Schuette for the additional funds for outside consultants. You had mentioned Todd Flood being part of this investigatory team. There has been some concern that there might be a conflict of interest at play here. Todd Flood has been a donor for both Governor Snyder and Attorney General Schuette. There's also the issue of the state defending Snyder and others in the administration while simultaneously investigating them for criminal wrongdoing. What is the state doing? You mentioned a firewall here to be sure those things, you know, never the two shall meet.
Yeah, exactly. The Attorney General's office does seem to be taking some extra steps here to ensure separation of those two, you know, roles that its office is playing. Todd Flood has been attacked mostly by Democrats as perhaps not an impartial observer here. It's worth noting that he also contributed to former Democratic Governor Jennifer Granholm. So, you know, you can pick and choose contributions, but he certainly has made some donations to Republicans who are now leading the investigation and perhaps fielding some of the blame for the crisis. That said, he's been very upfront that, you know, he's one of a large team here. He's, you know, says he's fully committed to finding the truth regardless of where it leads him. And of course, you know, you've got a large team, again, like I said, of 25 people who are going to be working on this. It's not simply Todd Flood. And from everything I've heard, he seems to be a pretty well-respected guy. And I think, you know, concerns about his past contributions, well, worthy of discussion, you know, aren't necessarily going to limit his ability to do his job effectively.
Let's look at some of the response that may be coming from the legislature on this, Jonathan. Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekoff has questioned the need to have a state-led investigation, given that there's a federal probe that's also happening right now. Again, why does Attorney General Schuette say that a state-led investigation is necessary on top of what's being done at the federal level?
Well, it's his job, is what he says. You know, he's not. He says he's not in this for the politics of it, for the press. He's in it to, you know, find out what happened. It's not unusual that the Attorney General's office would investigate something like this. As Senator Meekoff mentioned, there are other investigations ongoing, but that certainly doesn't preclude the state from moving forward. There's a little bit of an interesting political dynamic there with Arlen Meekoff and Bill Schuette, because both of them are potential gubernatorial candidates in 2018. You know, there could be some subtext there in those comments in terms of future political aspirations. You know, the question is going to be if the legislature is going to have to approve additional money for these investigations. Right now, the contractual request seems to be coming out of existing budget dollars. These are taxpayer funds, it doesn't sound like they've requested extra money just yet, which is where the legislature would come into play.
Now, the cost of this investigation and the outside legal consultants are rising at the same time that Michigan is also facing several lawsuits. There was a class action lawsuit filed earlier this week. What do we know about that particular lawsuit? We have any guess as to how many people that might impact?
Well, that particular lawsuit was filed on behalf of Leanne Walters and her children, in fact, who were exposed to lead in their drinking water. I believe her children actually have been tested, and it's been confirmed that they had elevated levels. Leanne Walters was a central player in this Flint water crisis from the beginning. She's the one who was desperately reaching out to anyone who would listen, and ended up actually working with the EPA and working with Mark Edwards, the Virginia Tech researcher who then came in and started studying this problem in greater depth. So her lawsuit targets, I actually believe it doesn't target the governor directly, but targets various state agencies and companies that helped, you know, did engineering studies for the city of Flint and seemingly along the line here never raised the, at least never stressed the importance of adding corrosion controls to the water, which ended up leaching lead into pipes. So that lawsuit was filed. There were seven others, I believe, filed the same day by the same attorneys on behalf of other Flint families. Again, those were sort of one at a time. Separately, I believe there's no fewer than three class action lawsuits against the state. So between those eight and three, were already looking at more than 10 lawsuits filed in this crisis. And those class action ones, of course, can grow depending on how many residents sign up to be a part of them. So these are going to be big cases. They're civil cases. They're probably going to be expensive, which is perhaps reflected in the governor's request for those additional legal fees.
Very good. We'll see how all this plays out in the days and weeks ahead. We've been talking about the mounting costs for the state of Michigan in the wake of the Flint water crisis. Our guest today has been political reporter for the Detroit News, Jonathan Oesting. Again, Jonathan, we appreciate you stopping by and giving us some insight. Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up later on Current State, for decades, scientists have been studying stem cells to unlock their secrets of regeneration. They can grow into any type of cell in the body. Now, a pair of scientists at Michigan State University say they've found a new type of stem cell that promises to further the study of regenerative medicine. I'll talk with that team about their discovery a little bit later on. It's Current State. I'm Kevin Lavery, in for Mark Bayshore. At the intersection of Hagedorn and Jolly Roads in Okemos stands a big red barn, which has turned into a bit of an artist colony. It's there that Current State's Jamie Paisley visited the Happen Dance Company ahead of their performance this weekend at Lansing Community College, and he spoke with the Happen Dance president, Missy Lilje.
As I walked into the lobby area that's at Happen Dance, there are various names on the right-hand side, Impulse, I believe, and what are those?
The Impulse is our student company, our pre-professional company, pre-collegiate. The dancers who are really seriously training, you know, 25 to 40 hours a week. And those are the kids that could have the option to be dance majors when they're done training here. But some of them, half of them, go on to be amazing in other areas as well. They choose different fields. And the curriculum that we offer here makes people great at being themselves, which is going to make them great at being in the world, doing whatever they choose.
And as you say, students, you don't entirely mean just, you know, youths that are they're coming at this, right?
Yes, our oldest student is 85 years old. So we're all about lifelong mental and physical and spiritual wellness through dance.
But the bulk of people, are they of the younger age?
We have 400 families that have kids here between the ages of 18 months and 18 years.
In addition to Happen Dance president Missy Lilje, I spoke with Lisa Whiting Dobson, the artistic director of Happen Dance Impulse. The program for this weekend's Happen Dance Impulse program is called simply Collected Works, a very broad term indeed. What should an audience expect to see for this assumedly varied performance?
What we try to do in this program is get our dancers acclimated to many different dance styles. So you're going to see jazz, you're going to see a little bit of world dance, you're going to see a lot of modern and contemporary, you'll see some lyrical, you'll see some very kind of edgy stuff, and then some more kind of classical kinds of work. And the idea is to broadly expose them to a number of different dance forms, because as a professional or as a college student, you have to be able to move between the disciplines. You can't just be good at modern. You have to be able to do modern and some ballet, and you may have a specialty, but you can't. You have to have experience in all of it. So we give them experiences. We also give them a lot of individual performing experience. So there are some group pieces where every dancer's involved, but also all of our junior and senior dancers have a solo that they choreograph. So they have to come up with their own creative voice. They have to make their own statement through their movement, and they perform that dance. We also have some small group pieces where they are challenged, and we bring in choreographers. Many of them are from Happen Dance, but some of them are from outside. And they do things to really grow those dancers. So they give them a choreographic opportunity that might be outside their comfort zone, so that they have to be challenged. We also really work with characterization, so that when they're in this dance, they perform like this kind of a person or dancer or with that motivation, and then they move to a different dance and they have to change character. So again, we're developing those skills that colleges really look for. You're going to see a dance today, and it's about post-traumatic stress disorder, for example. So the dancers had to go out, they had to find their own quote about trauma. And so there's some verbal work that they do, and then they do some ad-lib and freelance kinds of things, and then some improv, and then they go into a choreographed piece. And so there's some partnering, so you'll see kind of the response to trauma and the working through of trauma by the dancers, which is kind of an adult topic. Yeah. But yet these 9th through 12th graders are kind of grappling with how do you share this experience with an audience.
That is a very heavy topic. Do you suggest that being with parental involvement about how they're addressing this?
Well, most of these kids have really strong parental involvement, so they've shared, but we also talk to them about trauma. We talk to them about post-traumatic stress disorder. The choreographer, who is Jim McEwen, talked to them about that, and then we have supported them through the process. But they're wonderful young artists who have really risen to the challenge, and you'll see them work through, you'll see this piece in a little bit.
Forgiveness, awareness, inner peace, all of these are well and good. But at the end of the day, PTSD doesn't care.
A bandage is not patched with broken soul.
Some people's lives seem to flow in a narrative. Mine had many stops and starts. That's what trauma does. It interrupts the plot. You can't process it because it doesn't fit with what came before or what comes after. My name is Leah Baldori.
And in the dance that I just saw, when you're done that quote, you move to the back and you're kind of in an isolated position and you make a motion with your arm that you're then kind of cradling your arm for a moment. What is that supposed to be?
Well, during that time, Jim assigned the people who are all kind of in their own isolated positions to be enacting how they felt someone affected by trauma would emote that, like with their bodies, if that makes sense. And I don't know, something about that, like I imagine wounded and like hurt, so that makes me think like almost in a physical matter.
After watching this PTSD dance ahead of this weekend's Happen Dance Impulse performance at the Lansing Community College, there was a cheer that erupted over something.
You got in. Cool.
Katrina got in where?
Michigan.
Yay! I'm Katrina Granger, and I've been in Happy Dance Impulse for 2 years now.
Was there news that you just announced today?
Oh, yes. 2 days ago, I just received my acceptance into U of M's dance program. So that was very exciting.
How was that process of submitting yourself? Because I know that you have to submit before you actually do the audition for them.
Yeah, so actually U of M requires everyone to first submit videos of them doing a specific set of like modern combinations and ballet combination, just so that the people at U of M can see like your lines. And then based on those videos, they allow a certain number of people to actually attend the audition. So I made it through the video round, and so I got my audition. But luckily, I know a girl who used to dance here, Chloe Gonzalez, and so I kind of set up a day with her to go and like watch some classes. And it was cool because I walked up to watch a modern class with Bill DeYoung, and I was expecting just to be able to watch, and I was happy with that. But he actually allowed me to take the class, so I just jumped right in, and I think that definitely helped out. The teachers got to see me.
It's all about networking. From here on out, it's just networking. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All that is a credit to the system currently set up by the Happen Dance Company. Again, Happen Dance President Missy Lilje.
If somebody wanted to get involved with the Happen Dance community or Impulse, how would they go about doing that?
Well, they would have to contact us and audition with with Lisa. The auditions are in June, so the email address is pretty, you can go to the website happendance.org and figure out how to email us, but the email address is office@happendance.org, and we'll get the information to Lisa, and she'll get in touch with whoever is interested.
The Happen Dance Impulse Collected Works program has 3 performances this Friday through Sunday in the DART Auditorium at Lansing Community College. More information is available at happendance.org or at the Happen Dance Facebook page. For Current State, I'm Jamie Pace.
And coming up on Current States, MSU Athletic Director Mark Hollis opens up about fundraising for costly enhancements to the school's athletic facilities and about what he's learned after growing up an only child in a family contending with a mental disorder and an authoritative father. That and more coming up after the break. It's Current State from WKAR. I'm Kevin Lavery, in for Mark Bayshore, who is getting some sun, catching up on his vitamin D intake. Good for you, Mark. You know, vitamin D is good for stem cells, which are a much acclaimed and controversial topic in the scientific world. They're the building blocks that can grow into any specialized cell type in the body. Stem cells come from both embryo and adult tissues. A lot of stem cell research focuses on their ability to replace unhealthy cells. This is known as regenerative medicine. A pair of researchers at Michigan State University have discovered a new type of stem cell that they say could advance the field of regenerative medicine. Biochemist Amy Ralston and graduate student Anthony Parenti work in the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at Michigan State University. I visited their lab recently, and I first asked Dr. Ralston to explain what stem cells really are.
The two main categories are pluripotent stem cells and tissue stem cells. So pluripotent stem cells come from a variety of sources. One of those is the embryo. And the reason they're pluripotent is because they can make any cell type in the body. Tissue stem cells come mainly from established tissues and organs. You have tissue stem cells in your body right now. And those are still stem cells, but they have more limited potential. They can usually only replace one or two different types of cells in your body. But both are really important and interesting and exciting to study.
So a pluripotent cell, which I would loosely translate into all-powerful, essentially has the DNA or the blueprint inside that says this can be anything in the body.
It has the motivation to become absolutely anything.
Now, that's pluripotent cells, but the cells that you guys have come across are similar, but there are some distinct differences. What would you call it, an XN cell?
We call it iZen. We would classify iZen as being a tissue stem cell. And what's different between iZen and pluripotent stem cells is that pluripotent stem cells, while they can make any cell type of the body, they do not have the capacity to make any of the extra embryonic tissues, such as the placenta or the yolk sac or the amnion. So those are important tissues for normal fetal development. And iZen cells are tissue stem cells that come from the extra embryonic tissues. So these are complementary to what, they have complementary functions to what pluripotent stem cells can do.
Tony, I'll come to you. To loosely phrase this, you found these cells in the garbage.
yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it, but that is essentially what happened. So we've been doing this process to make the pluripotent stem cells called reprogramming. And in this process, a number of different cell types are made, but many people ignored anything that was not a pluripotent stem cell. So they often just threw them away. We said we found them in the trash because most people had ignored them.
Essentially, what we're talking about is the idea of reprogramming, getting an adult stem cell to in some way behave in a more malleable way like an embryonic stem cell does. I mean, an embryonic stem cell is obviously a much younger, newer, more flexible type cell, but this is the idea of transforming the cell of an adult and remembering what it was back in the old days.
That's right. So reprogramming is the process of taking an adult cell, any old dying cell from your body, and rejuvenating it and reminding it that it has the potential to become any cell type in the body. So it's a process that we do in the lab, and it's a process that received the Nobel Prize in 2012, because now we have a way to make pluripotent stem cells from individual people. And that means we no longer need to use human embryos to create pluripotent stem cells. And it also means that we have a way to make new disease models, because we can create pluripotent stem cells from people that are suffering with different diseases and then use those pluripotent stem cells to study those diseases.
Now, I don't want to get too far ahead, but does this have any potential for clearing up, resolving the raging debates we have in the world about the ethical use of embryonic stem cells?
Reprogramming definitely has the possibility of avoiding the use of human embryos, which is an important goal for scientists and non-scientists. We still have a long ways to go, as you said. One of the things that we think is really great about iZen cells is that currently there is no way to create extra embryonic tissue stem cells without using embryos until we made the discovery that we can use reprogramming to do that.
We're talking with Dr. Amy Ralston, an assistant professor in the Michigan State University Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology, and also with Anthony Parenti, who is a graduate student in the same department. How exactly did you come upon these iZen cells, and why has no one seen this before, at least recognized it in the way that you and Amy have?
So our lab actually specializes in understanding what's going on in development. So looking at the embryo, understanding what's going on with the different stem cells that we talked about. The extra embryonic tissue in particular is one thing that we've focused on. So we thought we can use what we've learned about the embryo to actually look at reprogramming and see if perhaps the cells that are not becoming the pluripotent stem cells, which is actually about 99% of the population, if perhaps maybe they're becoming this extra embryonic stem cell type.
Now my brain is already hurting, Amy, which means you need to regrow me a batch of stem cells from my dura mater. Can we do that right now?
I would be the wrong person to ask. I can grow you a yolk sac.
There you go. Well, if I ever need an extra yolk sac, I know who to come to.
So this is where we grow stem cells. We have a number of specialized pieces of equipment. We have a biosafety cabinet that keeps the cells sterile and it keeps us safe as well. An incubator, which grows the cells at body temperature. Microscope for looking at them. And then when they're not in use, they are here in the cryo storage. There's a styrofoam stopper and liquid nitrogen inside that keeps them very cold. They're in stasis until we're ready to do experiments.
When you're watching all this under a microscope, how can you tell when it's really happening?
That's a really good question, because there are, it really depends on who you ask. And one of the reasons that these cells were ignored previously is because we just weren't looking hard enough. And so we couldn't just look at them under the microscope and know that they were iZen cells. We had to put them through a number of tests. We looked at their molecular profile, at what molecule is present in these cells compared to other cells like them. We looked at, can they behave like stem cells in various assays, differentiation assays done in the incubator or in other settings. So that was actually probably the bulk of the work that we did for this project, was different ways to convince ourselves that these cells were iZen cells.
Tony, are you at a point yet in your research where this is having some practical explanation, that people can see some sort of a viable reason to continue doing this?
Absolutely. I think that we've actually finally just gotten to a point where we can actually say to the public, I say this to my mother all the time, here's why we care about this. These cells, these iZen cells that we discovered, represent, like I told you, the extra embryonic tissue. There are a number of different developmental diseases as far as things like infertility, miscarriages, that we just physically cannot study because we do not have the cells to be able to do this. iZen actually represent a way for us to study these different diseases to hopefully get at a point where maybe we can move past things like some of the infertility issues that are going on today.
So Tony, where can this go now? Is there some sort of a clinical trial?
Yeah, so I think the next step, so everything that we've done here today, we had to do initially in mice. There's a lot more tools for us to actually do research in mouse models. So we started with mouse to see if this is even something that's happening at all. The next step from here would be to do human reprogramming, which is currently being done at a number of different labs around the country, to see if iZen cells are made during human reprogramming as well. And that would be the point. If we can actually generate iZen cells from humans, then we could then start looking towards diseases and clinical models.
Dr. Amy Ralston is an assistant professor in the Michigan State University Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology. Anthony Parenti is a graduate student also in the same department, and the two of them have been working on extra embryonic endoderm stem cells, also called iZen cells, which is a discovery of a new type of stem cells. Anthony, thank you.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Amy, thank you.
Thanks for your time. Love your show.
Thank you. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery. Last week on Current State, Michigan State University Athletic Director Mark Hollis shared his thoughts on the postseason prospects for the men's and women's basketball teams in spring sports. He also described infrastructure and design renovations at the Breslin Student Event Center. In 2018, the home of Spartan basketball will become home to an MSU Basketball Hall of History and a 26,000-square-foot entryway. In part two of his talk with Mark Hollis, Current State's Mark Bayshore asked about the fundraising involved in such projects.
How do you feel about reaching out to potential donors and asking for money? I mean, you hear it's a political season. You hear about politicians constantly having to ask for money And I mean, we're talking about inordinately large sums of money here a lot of time. Do you like that part of your job? Is that a challenge that you just soon not have, or how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I don't approach fundraising as a salesman. I approach fundraising as value for an institution that had an impact on your life. And, you know, Nancy and I made a decision to give $1 million back to the school, with half of that going to athletics and half of it going to a scholarship from a student from the state of Michigan, with aspirations that they would continue to make our state better after graduating. If you can frame things in such a way that this place had such a positive impact on me and on what I've become, it's easy for me to frame that in others' minds that have the capacity, have resources, and really let them tell what they want to do and why they want to give. It's not, you know, we have this widget and we want you to buy it. We want you to invest in something that's meaningful and had an impact. When you look at the John and Becky Duffy, very much so. Individuals that had a wedding proposal, marriage proposal that took place in Spartan Stadium. Things like that those are the stories that are great. And I think it's less of a sales job. Chuck Sleeper and his staff and the Spartan Fund do a great job, but it's the people that want to step forward and do things because of the opportunities they've had as a Spartan.
On a more serious note, back in December, the state Supreme Court refused to hear the university's appeal requesting not to have to disclose the specific names of student athletes at Michigan State suspected of crimes. This was triggered by ESPN's FOIA request for those names. Can you tell us, have the names been turned over to ESPN?
Well, the university is obviously complying with the legal system and the rulings that came down. It's a situation that's much bigger than college sports, and it's one that I'm not comfortable talking about because it's bigger than the athletic department. So I'm gonna leave those questions unanswered, but know that, you know, this university is taking the appropriate steps for everybody's best interest.
Wonder if I might ask you this. I mean, the university has cited privacy concerns for redacting the names the first time, and some people cite the public's right to know. Do you feel the public has a right to know?
Again, I'm going to let the university be the spokesperson on this. It's you know, there are times when you have opinions about certain things, and it's best to keep those opinions to yourself, especially in cases like this that are still in process.
Last summer, you shared some details, some challenges of your life growing up in Lexington in the eastern part of the state near Port Huron. Your late mother apparently suffered from a disorder, Munchausen syndrome. Your parents divorced, and you were very candid about the challenges that presented. First off, what is Munchausen syndrome?
Well, it's a condition where you basically feel that you are always sick, need to inflict pain upon yourself, and then you start to project that onto others. And, you know, growing up, you think you have a perfect world, and you quickly realize that nobody has a perfect world, and everybody has challenges. And by coming forward and talking about, you know, some of the issues that I had, relatively speaking, maybe not as great as many others out there, it makes individuals understand that they're not alone. And no matter what the situation is, no matter how depressing or the despair you may feel, somebody has felt that before. I ended up having a good relationship with my dad after several years of not talking. I ended up comfortable with my mom, you know, before she passed away, but very disconnected for a lot of different reasons. And I know everyone, you know, divorce is hard on kids. I think relationships are always a challenge, and individuals struggle with themselves at times. And it's best to find someone to talk to, because once you talk, you realize you're not alone. And that was the message I was trying to deliver.
But you were an only child as well. Did that make it more difficult? Were there times?
Yeah, it made it more difficult at the time, and it made it more difficult, I think, in the amount of time it took me to discuss it, because, you know, growing up, you had to be creative and kind of find things to do by yourself when friends weren't around. So you're a little bit more, you hold things a little bit closer. I think my management style, I hold things pretty close, trying to achieve perfection. You know, your past impacts the way you are. And if people can understand that past, I think they have a better appreciation for how you make decisions and how you go through. So the only child thing, it comes with its challenges. You always want that brother and sister, and you have to find other ways to kind of go around those close relationships.
You suggest that you contend with this today, though, too. I know in Joe Rexroad's story here, he kind of half tongue-in-cheek, I guess, said, your staff laments how long it takes you to make a decision, and you say that you think of the high fear factor that you had as a kid, petrified of making a mistake and incurring the considerable wrath of your father. This still is something you contend with today.
Oh, it is. It's, you know, the pursuit of perfection can never be achieved. And my dad, he was both a minister, a preacher, and a principal and superintendent of schools, so it's kind of like the double whammy.
The ultimate authority figure there.
The ultimate authority figure. And, you know, my dad went through a lot of challenges, and a lot of that stress from those challenges got put out on me. And there are times when, you know, I would make the slightest of mistakes and be severely reprimanded for it. There are times when I was just living my life as a high school kid or middle school kid and would have challenges. So it's, again, I don't want to stress that I'm any more severe than maybe some others, but there were some impactful things that happened to me that I think to this day, I'm afraid of making a mistake so much that you really try to achieve that perfection and it delays your thought process a little bit. So my staff have to push me a little bit, help me with this decision. Did you decide on this yet? And
That's amazing, though, because I think the public perception of you is as a pretty authoritative, decisive kind of guy. I mean, you're credited with moving.
No, I am what I have to be, Mark.
Moving athletics.
Yeah, no, I am what I have to be. But it's, you know, things like if you look at some of our special events, like the Carrier Classic took 8 years from thought to execution. And those 8 years were a fear of what if things went wrong? What if this went wrong? What if, you know, the hockey game, what if people didn't show up? Well, those are extreme examples, but it really comes back to every day that how can we, you know, how can we move forward in a positive way and be as good as we possibly can to everybody's thought process, knowing that you're never going to achieve 100% satisfaction rates.
Was going public with the Rexroad article, was that helpful? Was that therapeutic in any way?
Yeah, I suppose so. Looking back, I think the most therapeutic thing is the new friends that I've established that have had challenges in their own lives, very high-profile people in this country that reached out to me, presidents of universities, media, dignitaries.
So once you were out there with that aspect of your life,
it opened up a whole new level of friendships,
connections that you didn't have before.
They reached out and said, "I am so glad you did that. I've felt the same way for this reason." And you know, you have the ability to become a better person by listening to their story. You've opened up a door for other people to feel better about themselves.
Mark Hollis is the athletics director for Michigan State University. Hope it's a great spring. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
It's Current State. I'm Kevin Lavery. This Saturday night at 8 o'clock, the Ann Arbor Symphony Orchestra explores three centuries of great music in concert at the Michigan Theater. It's also a live broadcast on 90.5 Classical. Music director R.E.A. Lipsky will lead the A2SO in an overture by Handel, plus Brahms' Second Symphony and Alberto Ginastera's Harp Concerto. In a conversation with WKAR's Peter Wharf, Lipsky says that although Ginastera was a prolific composer, his harp concerto was a work he wrestled with for nearly a decade.
So as a result, since he studied the instrument so well, he wrote which probably is the king of the harp concertos. It takes the harp from the traditional role that we think of the angelic instrument that plays something which is always so spiritual to a very earthy instrument. It becomes a percussion instrument.
¶¶
all about color and rhythm. The last movement is a malambo, which is a traditional Argentinian dance of the gauchos, the Argentinian cowboys.
You know, he wrote another pretty famous malambo, too.
Of course, in Estancia. Right. It's very colorful, and we're really looking forward to do that. I've conducted that before, but Primor, this is the first time, and we're just having so much fun.
Tell me about your harp soloist.
Her name is Primor Sloprin. And she comes from Belgium. I know her very well because she happens to be my niece. It's nice to bring her over and have a family visit, but she's also a great musician, so it's fun to do that together.
Tell me about your horn soloist right now that we're hearing in the background.
Well, we're getting ready for Brahms Symphony.
Well, there you go.
It doesn't get more challenging to the horn.
Yeah, you don't have a more prominent horn part than the opening of the Brahms Second Symphony. The second half of the program will be devoted to Brahms' Second Symphony, a work that closely followed the First Symphony, relatively close when you consider that he spent, the first four decades of his life getting ready, being prepared to write his First Symphony, and then the Second Symphony came pretty closely after. I was reading some of what Brahms said about his Second Symphony. He actually wrote to somebody calling it a melancholy work, one that he said was sure would fail. Was he serious?
I think he was joking, because he just contradicted himself after the premiere of the symphony. But you are right. I mean, Brahms had a hard time creating a work which is known as a symphony, and until he was about 40. And really struggled with the First Symphony, but once he did it, it just came right one after the other, and he felt quite comfortable in that milieu of the symphony. Pastoral than the rest of the symphony, and a little darker. And one of the reasons that he is using the three trombones and a tuba. This is the only symphony that he uses a tuba. And also he used this low brass choir in three out of the four movements. He used trombones in other symphonies as well, but perhaps in one or two movements at the most. But here, there are three of them. But then, the last movement, he uses the trombone and the tuba to create this blaze of joy and exuberance in the finale of the brass fanfare. Right. And it's a crowd pleaser, and we just love playing that. And I hope that comes out to the audience.
Ari Lipsky is music director of the Ann Arbor Symphony Orchestra. They'll perform Handel, Ginastera, and Brahms Saturday night at the Michigan Theater in Ann Arbor. Thanks, Ari.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to the concert.
In Ann Arbor with music director Ari Lipsky, I'm Peter Worf for Current State.
And that's our show for today. Tune in tomorrow for a special encore edition of The Best of Current State. And Mark is back on Monday with another week of your daily dose of news, politics, and arts and culture. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. Remember, you can connect with Current State on social media at KAR Current State on Twitter and on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. I'm Kevin Lavery, in for Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State here on WKAR.